alone with the last few bites of his quiche, now gone cold. At Lexi's request, Mrs. McCullough took her for a tour of Mirabelle's room. Decorated in pink and pale green, with a hand-stitched banner above the crib spelling out her name. "She loves this rug," Mrs. McCullough said, patting the sheepskin on the floor. "We put her down after her bath, and she rolls around and just laughs and laughs." Then there was Mirabelle's playroom, a whole enormous bedroom devoted to her toys. Wooden blocks in all colors of the rainbow, a rocking elephant made from velvet, an entire shelf of dolls. "The room at the front of the house is bigger," explained Mrs. McCullough, "but this room gets the best sun, all morning and most of the afternoon. So we made the other into the guest room and kept this one as a place for Mirabelle to play." When they returned downstairs, even more guests had arrived, and Lexi reluctantly relinquished Mirabelle to the newcomers. By cake-cutting time, the birthday girl, worn out from all the socializing, had to be whisked away for a bottle and put down for a nap. And to Lexi's great disappointment, she was still asleep at the end of the party when the Richardsons headed home. "I wanted to hold her again," she complained as they made their way back to their cars. "She's a baby, not a toy, Lex," Moody put in. "I'm sure Mrs. McCullough would love it if you'd offer to babysit," Mrs. Richardson said. "Drive carefully, Lexi. We'll see you at home." She nudged Izzy toward the other car by one shoulder. "And you need to be less rude next time we go to a party, or you can just stay home. Linda McCullough babysat you when you were little, you know. She changed your diapers and took you to the park. You think about that the next time you see her." "I will," said Izzy and slammed her car door. Lexi could talk of nothing else but Mirabelle McCullough for the next few days. "Baby fever," Tripp said and nudged Brian.
"Watch out, dude."
Brian laughed uneasily. Tripp was right, though. Lexi was suddenly, furiously interested in all things baby, even going to Dillard's to buy a frilly and thoroughly impractical lavender dress as a present for Mirabelle.
"My God, Lexi, I don't remember you being so excited about babies when Moody and Izzy were little," her mother said. "Or dolls, for that matter. In fact," Mrs. Richardson cast her mind back, "once you actually shut Moody in the pots and pans cupboard."
Lexi rolled her eyes. "I was 3, she said. She was still talking about the baby on Monday, and when Mia arrived in the kitchen that afternoon, Lexi was delighted to have a fresh audience. "Her hair is so gorgeous," she gushed. "I've never seen so much hair on a little baby. So silky. And she has the biggest eyes. They just take everything in. She's so alert. They found her at a fire station. Can you believe that? Someone literally just left her there." Across the room, Mia, who had been wiping the countertops, froze. "A fire station?" she said. "A fire station where?" Lexi waved a hand. "I don't know. Somewhere in East Cleveland, I think." The details had been less important to her than the tragic romance of it all. "And when did this happen?"
"January, something like that. Mrs. McCullough said that one of the firemen came out for a smoke and found her there in a cardboard box."
Lexi shook her head.
"Like she was a puppy someone didn't want."
"And now the McCulloughs plan to keep her?"
"I think so." Lexi opened the cupboard and helped herself to a Nutri-Grain bar. "They wanted a baby forever, and then Mirabelle appeared. Like a miracle. And they've been trying to adopt for so long. They'll be such devoted parents."
She peeled the wrapper from the granola bar and popped it into the garbage can and went upstairs, leaving Mia deep in thought. Mia's arrangement with Mrs. Richardson paid for their rent, but she and Pearl still needed money for groceries and the power bill and gas, so she had kept a few shifts per week at Lucky Palace, which between wages and leftover food was just enough to keep them supplied. Lucky Palace had a cook, a prep cook, a busboy, and one full-time waitress, Bibi, who had started a few months before Mia. Bibi had come over from Canton 2 years earlier, and although her English was rather choppy, she liked to talk with Mia, finding her a sympathetic listener who never corrected her grammar or seemed to have trouble understanding her. While they rolled plastic silverware and napkins for the dinner takeout orders, Bibi had told Mia quite a lot about her life. Mia shared very little in return, but she'd learned over the years that people seldom noticed this if you were a good listener, which meant you kept the other person talking about herself. Over the course of the past 6 months, she'd learned nearly all of Bibi's life story. And it was because of this that Lexi's account of the party had caught her attention. For Bibi, a year earlier, had had a baby.
I'm so scared, Ben, she told Mia, fingers working the soft paper of the napkin. I have nobody to help me. I cannot go to work. I cannot sleep. All day long, I just hold the baby and cry.
Where was the baby's father? Mia had asked. And Bibi had said, gone.
I tell him I'm having a baby. 2 weeks later, he disappear. Somebody told me he moved back to Guangdong. I move here for him, you know that? Before that, we living in San Francisco. I am work in dentist office as a receptionist. I get good money, really nice boss. He get a job here in the car plant. He said Cleveland is nice. Cleveland is cheap. San Francisco so expensive. We move to Cleveland. We can buy a house, have a yard. So I follow him here. And then... She was silent for a moment. Then dropped a neat, rolled-up napkin onto the pile. Chopsticks, fork, and knife all swaddled together inside. Here, nobody speak Chinese, she said. I interview for receptionist. They tell me my English not good enough. Nowhere I can find work. Nobody to watch the baby.
She'd probably had postpartum depression at the very least, Mia realized. Perhaps even a postpartum psychotic break. The baby wouldn't nurse, and her milk had dried up. She had lost her job, a minimum wage post packing styrofoam cups into cartons when she'd gone into the hospital to have the baby, and had no money for formula. At last, and this was the part that Mia felt could not be a coincidence, she had, in desperation, gone to a fire station and left her baby on the doorstep. Two policemen had found Bibi several days later lying under a park bench, unconscious from dehydration and hunger. They'd brought her to a shelter where she'd been showered, fed, prescribed antidepressants, and released 3 weeks later. But by then, no one could tell her what had happened to her baby. A fire station, she had insisted. She'd left the baby at a fire station. No, she couldn't remember which. She had walked with the baby in her arms, round and round the city, trying to figure out what to do. And at last she'd passed a station, the windows glowing warm against the dark night, and she'd made up her mind. How many fire stations could there be? But no one would help her. When you left her, you terminated your rights, the police told her. Sorry, we can't give you any more information. Bibi, Mia knew, was desperate to find her daughter again. Had been searching for her for many months now, ever since she'd gotten herself back together. She had a job now, a steady, if low-paying one. She'd found a new apartment. Her mood had stabilized. But she hadn't been able to find out where her baby had gone. It was as if her child had simply disappeared.
Sometimes, she told Mia, I wonder if I am dreaming.
But which one is the dream? She dabbed her eyes with the back of her cuff.
That I can't find my baby? Or that I have the baby at all?
In all her years of itinerant living, Mia had developed one rule. Don't get attached. To any place, to any apartment, to anything. To anyone. Since Pearl had been born, they'd lived, by Mia's count, in 46 different towns, keeping their possessions to what would fit in a Volkswagen, in other words, to a bare minimum. They seldom stayed long enough to make friends anywhere, and in the few cases where they had, they'd moved on with no forwarding address and lost contact. At each move, they discarded everything they could leave behind, and sent off Mia's art to Anita to be sold, which meant they'd never see it again. So Mia had always avoided getting involved in the affairs of others. It made everything simpler. It made it easier when their lease was up, or she'd grown tired of the town, or she'd felt, uneasily, that she wanted to be elsewhere. But this, with Bibi, this was different. The idea that someone might take a mother's child away. It horrified her. It was as if someone had slid a blade into her and with one quick twist hollowed her out, leaving nothing inside but a cold rush of air. At that moment, Pearl came into the kitchen in search of a drink, and Mia wrapped her arms around her daughter quickly, as if she were on the edge of a precipice, and held her so long and so tightly that Pearl finally said, "Mom, are you okay?" These McCulloughs, Mia was sure, were good people. But that wasn't the point. She thought suddenly of those moments at the restaurant, after the dinner rush had ended and things were quiet, when Bibi sometimes rested her elbows on the counter and drifted away. Mia understood exactly where she drifted to. To a parent, your child wasn't just a person. Your child was a place, a kind of Narnia, a vast, eternal place where the present you were living and the past you remembered and the future you longed for all existed at once. You could see it every time you looked at her. Layered in her face was the baby she'd been and the child she'd become and the adult she would grow up to be. And you saw them all simultaneously like a 3D image. It made your head spin. It was a place you could take refuge if you knew how to get in. And each time you left it, each time your child passed out of your sight, you feared you might never be able to return to that place again. Early on, the very first night she and Pearl had begun their travels, Mia had curled up on their makeshift bed in the back seat of the Rabbit, with baby Pearl snuggled in the curve of her belly, and watched her daughter sleep. There, so close that she could feel Pearl's warm, milky breath on her cheek, she had marveled at this little creature. "Bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh," she had thought. Her mother had made her go to Sunday school every week until she was 13, and as if the words were a spell, she suddenly saw hints of her mother's face in Pearl's. The set of the jaw, the faint wrinkle between the eyebrows that appeared as Pearl drifted into a puzzling dream. She had not thought about her mother in some time, and a sharp bolt of longing flashed through her chest. As if it had disturbed her, Pearl yawned and stretched, and Mia had cuddled her closer, stroked her hair, pressed her lips to that unbelievably soft cheek. "Bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh," she had thought again, as Pearl's eyes fluttered closed once more. And she was certain that no one could ever love this child as she did. "I'm fine," she said to Pearl now, and with a wrenching effort, she let her daughter go. "All finished here. Let's go home, okay?" Even then, Mia had a sense of what she was starting. A hot smell pricked her nostrils, like the first wisp of smoke from a far-off blaze. She did not know if Bibi would get her baby back. All she knew was that the thought of someone else claiming her child was unbearable. How could these people, she thought, how could these people take a child from its mother? She told herself this all night and into the next morning, as she dialed, as she waited for the phone to ring. It wasn't right. A mother should never have to give up her child. "Bibi," she said, when a voice picked up on the other end. "It's Mia, from work. There's something I think you should know." 10. This was why, while Pearl and Mia were eating dinner Tuesday evening, the doorbell rang, followed by a frantic knocking. Mia ran down to the side door, and Pearl heard a murmur of voices and crying, and then her mother came into the kitchen, followed by a young Chinese woman who was sobbing.
"I knock and knock," Bibi was saying. "I ring the doorbell, and they don't answer, so I knock and knock. I can see that woman inside, peeking out from behind the curtain to check if I go away."
Mia guided her to a chair, her own, with a plate of half-finished noodles still in front of it. "Pearl, get Bibi some water, and maybe make some tea." She sat down in the other chair and leaned across the table to take Bibi's hand. "You shouldn't have just gone over there like that. You couldn't expect them to just let you come right in."
"I call her first," Bibi wiped her face on the back of her hand. And Mia took a napkin from the table and nudged it toward her. It was actually an old flowered handkerchief from the thrift store, and Bibi scrubbed at her eyes.
I looked them up in the phone book and called them right after I hang up with you. Nobody answer. I just get the machine. What kind of message I am going to leave? So I try them again and again all morning until finally somebody answer at 2 o'clock. She answer.
Across the kitchen, Pearl set the kettle on the stove and clicked on the burner. She had never met Bibi before, though her mother had mentioned her once or twice. Her mother hadn't said how pretty Bibi was. Big eyes, high cheekbones, thick black hair swept up into a ponytail. Or how young. To Pearl, anyone over about 20 seemed impossibly adult, but she guessed that Bibi might be 25 or so. Definitely younger than her mother, but there was something almost childish in the way she spoke. In the way she sat, with her feet primly together and her hands clasped. In the way she glanced up at Mia helplessly, as if she were Mia's daughter too, that made her think of Bibi as if she were another teenager. Pearl did not realize, nor would she for a while yet, how unusually self-possessed her mother was for someone her age. How savvy and seasoned.
I tell her who I am, Bibi was saying. I say, this is Linda McCullough, and she say yes, and I tell her. My name is Bibi Chow. I am Mei Ling's mother. Just like that, she hang up on me.
Mia shook her head.
I call her back, and she pick up the phone and hang it up again. And then I call her again, and I get just a busy signal.
Bibi wiped her nose with a napkin and crumpled it into a ball.
So I go over there. Two buses, and I have to ask the driver where to change, and then I walk another mile to their house. Those huge houses. Everybody over there drive. No one wants to take a bus to work. I ring the front doorbell, and nobody answer. But she watching from upstairs, just looking down at me. I ring the bell again and again, and I calling, Mrs. McCullough, it's me, Bibi. I just want to talk to you. And then the curtain close. But she's still in there, just waiting for me to go away. Like I am going to go away when my baby is in there. So I keep on knocking and ringing. Sooner or later she have to come out, and then I can talk to her.
She glanced at Mia.
I just want to see my baby again. I think I can talk with these McCulloughs and get them to understand. But she will not come out.
Bibi fell silent for a long time and looked down at her hands. And Pearl saw the skin reddened and raw along the sides of her fists. She must have been banging on the door for a long, long time, she realized. And she thought simultaneously of how much pain Bibi must have been in, must still be in, and how terrified Mrs. McCullough, locked inside the house, must have felt. The rest of the story poured out haltingly, as if Bibi were only now piecing the scene together herself. Sometime later, Alexis had pulled up, with a police car right behind it, and Mr. McCullough had emerged. He had told Bibi to leave the property, two police officers flanking him like bodyguards. Bibi had tried to tell them she only wanted to see her baby, but wasn't sure now what she had said, if she had argued or threatened or raged or begged. All she could remember was the line Mr. McCullough kept repeating.
You have no right to be here. You have no right to be here.
And finally, one of the officers took her by the arm and pulled her away.
Go, they had said, or they would take her down to the station and charge her with trespassing.
This she recalled clearly, as the policeman pulled her away from the house. She could hear her child crying from behind the locked front door.
Oh, Bibi, Mia said,
and Pearl could not tell if she was disappointed or proud. what else I can do. I walk all the way here. 45 minutes. Who else I can ask for help but you?
She glared at Pearl and Mia fiercely, as if she thought they might contradict her.
I am her mother.
They know that, Mia said. They know that very well, or they wouldn't have run you off like that. She nudged the mug of tea, lukewarm now, toward Bibi.
What I can do now? If I go over there again, they call the police and arrest me.
You could get a lawyer, Pearl suggested, and Bibi gave her a gentle, pitying glance.
Where I am going to get money for a lawyer? She asked.
She glanced down at her clothing, black pants and a thin white button-down, and Pearl understood suddenly. This was her work uniform. She'd left work without even bothering to change.
In the bank, I have $611. You think a lawyer helped me for $611?
Okay, said Mia. She pushed the remains of Pearl's dinner, glazed now, with a white sheen of fat to one side. All this time she had been thinking. In fact, she'd been thinking about this ever since Lexi had mentioned the baby. About what she would do if she were in Bibi's position. About what it was possible for anyone in Bibi's position to do. Listen to me. Do you want to fight this fight? Here's what you do. Wednesday afternoon. Had any of the Richardson children been paying attention to the commercials during Jerry Springer, they might have noticed the teasers for the Channel 3 evening news, with a photo of the McCulloughs' house. If they had, they might have notified their mother, who was hammering out a story on a proposed school levy and would not be home to watch the news, or to alert Mrs. McCullough. But as it happened, Lexi and Tripp were so involved in a spirited argument over which guest had better hair, the drag queen or his embittered ex-wife, that no one heard the commercials. Pearl and Moody, looking on in bemusement, didn't even glance at the screen, and Lexi had interrupted before Tripp was halfway through his case for the drag queen. Izzy, meanwhile, was at Mia's in the darkroom, watching her pull a new print from the developer and hang it to dry. So no one saw the teasers for the nightly news or watched the news that evening. Mrs. McCullough was also not a news watcher, and thus, when she answered her doorbell early Thursday morning with Mirabelle on her hip, expecting a parcel from her sister, she was alarmed to find Barbara Pierce, Channel 9's bouffanted local investigative journalist, standing on her front steps with a microphone in hand.
"Mrs. McCullough!"
Barbara cried, as if they'd run into each other at a party and it was all a delightful coincidence. Behind her loomed a burly cameraman in a parka, though all Mrs. McCullough registered was the barrel of a lens and a blinking red light like one glowing eye. Mirabelle began to cry.
"We understand that you're in the process of adopting a little girl. Are you aware her mother is fighting to regain custody?"
Mrs. McCullough slammed the door shut, but the news crew had gotten what they'd come for. Only 2.5 seconds of footage, but it was enough. The slender white woman at the door of her imposing brick shaker house, looking angry and afraid, clutching the screaming Asian baby in her arms. With a vague sense of foreboding, Mrs. McCullough checked the clock. Her husband was en route to work downtown and would not be there for another 35 minutes at least. She called one friend after another, but none of them had seen the news story the night before either, and they could offer only moral support, not enlightenment.
"Don't worry," each said in turn. "It'll be okay. Just Barbara Pierce stirring up trouble."
Mr. McCullough, meanwhile, arrived at work and took the elevator up to the 7th floor, where Rayburn Financial Services had their offices. He had just extricated one arm from his overcoat when Ted Rayburn appeared in his doorway.
"Listen, Mark," he said. "I don't know if you saw the news last night on Channel 3, but there's something you should know about."
He shut the door behind him, and Mr. McCullough listened, still clutching his overcoat against himself as if it were a towel. Ted Rayburn, in the same measured, slightly concerned tones he used with clients, described the news segment, The outside shot of the McCulloughs' house, shaded in the evening light, but still familiar to him from their years of hosting cocktail parties, brunches, summer barbecues. The anchor's lead-in. Adoptions are about giving new homes to children who don't have families. But what if the child already has a family? And the interview with the mother, B-something, Ted hadn't caught the full name, who had begged for her baby on camera. "I make a mistake," she said, every syllable carefully enunciated.
"Now I have a good job. I have my life together now. I want my baby back. These McCulloughs have no right to adopt a baby when her own mother wants her. A child belongs with her mother."
Ted Rayburn had nearly finished when the phone on the desk rang, and Mr. McCullough, seeing the number, knew that it was his wife and what was happening and what he would now have to explain to her. He picked up the receiver.
"I'm coming home," he said, and set it down again and picked up his keys.
Mia, who did not own a television, had not seen the news segment either. But Wednesday afternoon, just before it aired, Bibi dropped by to tell her how the interview had gone.
"They think this is a good story," she said.
She was wearing her black pants and a white shirt with a faded soy sauce stain on the cuff, and from this Mia knew she was headed into work.
"They talked to me for almost an hour. They have very many questions for me."
She broke off at the sound of footsteps on the stairs. It was Izzy, just arrived from school, and both of them fell silent at the sight of a stranger.
"I better go," Bibi said after a moment. "The bus coming soon."
On the way out the door, she leaned close to Mia.
"They say people really going to get behind me," she whispered.
"Who was that?" Izzy asked when Bibi had gone. "Just a friend," Mia had answered. "A friend from work." The producers at Channel 3, as it turned out, had good instincts. In the hours after the segment aired, the station had been flooded with calls about the story, enough to warrant a follow-up, and enough for Channel 9, ever competitive, to deploy Barbara Pierce first thing the next morning.
"Barbara Pierce,"
Linda McCullough said to Mrs. Richardson Thursday evening.
"Barbara Pierce, with her stilettos and her Dolly Parton hair, showed up on my doorstep and shoved a microphone in my face."
The two women had just watched Barbara Pierce's segment, each on her own couch in front of the television holding the cordless phone to her ear. And Mrs. Richardson had the sudden, eerie feeling that they were 14 again, princess phones in their laps, watching Green Acres in tandem so that they could hear each other laugh. "That's what Barbara Pierce does," Mrs. Richardson said. "Ms. Sensational Action News in a skirt suit. She's a bully with a cameraman."
"The lawyer says we're on solid footing," Mrs. McCullough said. "He says that by leaving the baby, she gave up custody to the state, and the state gave it to us, so her grievance is really with the state and not us. He says the process is 80% complete, and it'll only take another month or two for Mirabelle to be ours permanently, and then this woman will have no claim on her at all."
They had tried so long, she and her husband, for a baby. After their wedding, she'd gotten pregnant right away. And then a few weeks later, she'd begun bleeding. And she knew even before they consulted the doctor that the baby was gone. "Very common," the doctor had reassured her. "Half of all pregnancies end in the first few weeks. Most women don't even know they'd conceived." But Mrs. McCullough had known. And 3 months later, when it happened again, and again 4 months after that, and again 5 months after that, she had been painfully aware, each time, that something alive had sparked in her, and that somehow that little spark had gone out. The doctors prescribed patience, vitamins, iron supplements. Another pregnancy came. This time it was nearly 10 weeks before the bleeding began. Mrs. McCullough cried at night, and after she fell asleep, her husband cried beside her. After 3 years of trying, she had been pregnant 5 times and there was still no baby. "Wait 6 months," the obstetrician recommended. "Let your body recover." When the waiting period was up, they tried again. 2 months later, she was pregnant. A month later, she was not. Each time she told no one, hoping that if she sealed the knowledge tight inside her, it would stay and grow. Nothing changed. By then, her old friend Elena had a girl and a boy and was pregnant with a third. And though Elena called often, though she would happily have taken Linda into her arms and let her cry, as they'd done so often for each other growing up, over big things and small, Mrs. McCullough found this was something she could not share. She never told Elena when she was pregnant, so how could she tell her the pregnancy had ended? She did not even know how to begin. I lost another one. It happened again. Whenever they had lunch, Mrs. McCullough could not keep herself from staring at Mrs. Richardson's rounding belly. She felt like a pervert. She so badly wanted to touch it, to stroke it, to caress it. In the background, Lexi and Tripp babbled and tottered, and it became easier after a while to simply avoid it all. Mrs. Richardson, for her part, noticed that her dear friend Linda called her less, that when she herself called, she often got the machine. Mrs. McCullough's cheery voice singing, "Leave a message for Linda or Mark, and we'll call you back." But no one ever did. The year after Izzy was born, Mrs. McCullough became pregnant again. By then it was exhausting. The plotting of her cycle, the waiting, the calls to the doctor. Even the sex, carefully scheduled for her most fertile days, had begun to feel like a chore. Who'd ever have believed it, she thought, remembering high school when she and Mark had fumbled frantically against each other in the backseat of his car. The doctors put her on strict bed rest. No more than 40 minutes a day on her feet, including trips to the bathroom. No exertions. She made it to almost 5 months before she woke at 2 a.m. with a terrible stillness in her belly, like the silence after a bell has stopped ringing. At the hospital, while she lay in a drugged fog, the doctors coaxed the baby from her womb. "Do you want to see her?" one asked when it was over. And a nurse held out the baby, swaddled in a white cloth, in her cupped palms. To Mrs. McCullough, she looked impossibly tiny, impossibly rose-colored, impossibly glossy and smooth, like something blown from pink glass, impossibly still. She nodded vaguely, shut her eyes again, spread her legs to let the doctors stitch her up. She began to walk the long way around to the store to avoid the playground, the elementary school, the bus stop. She began to hate pregnant women. She wanted to slap them, to throw things at them, to grab them by the shoulders and bite them. On their 10th wedding anniversary, Mr. McCullough took her to Giovanni's, her favorite restaurant, and as they entered, a vastly pregnant woman waddled up behind them. Mrs. McCullough pushed the door open and then, as the pregnant woman came up behind, let it shut in the woman's face. And Mr. McCullough, turning back to take his wife's arm, for a moment could not recognize this woman. So callous, so different from the endlessly maternal woman he'd always known. Finally, after one last doctor's appointment full of heart-rending phrases, low motility sperm, inhospitable womb, conception likely impossible, they decided to adopt. Even IVF would likely fail, the doctors had advised them. Adoption was their best chance for a baby. They'd put their names on every waiting list they could find, and from time to time an adoption agent would call with a possible match, but something always fell through. The mother changed her mind. A father or a cousin or a grandmother showed up out of the blue. The agency decided another, often younger, couple was a better fit. A year passed, then two, then three. Everyone, it seemed, wanted a baby, and demand far exceeded supply. That January morning, when the social worker had called to say that she'd gotten their name from one of the adoption agencies, that she had a baby who was theirs if they wanted her, it had felt like a miracle. If they wanted her. All that pain, all that guilt, those seven little ghosts. For Mrs. McCullough never forgot a single one. Had, to her amazement, packed themselves into a box and whisked themselves away at the sight of baby Mirabelle. So concrete, so vivid, so inescapably present. Now, at the thought that Mirabelle might be taken as well, Mrs. McCullough realized that the box and its contents had never disappeared, that they had simply been stored away, waiting for someone to open the lid. The news had cut to commercial, and through the line, Mrs. Richardson could hear the tinny jingle of the Cedar Point ad on the McCullough set, a fraction of a second behind her own. She watched an elderly woman stumble, fall, fumble for the transmitter around her neck, and Barbara Pierce's voiceover echoed in her mind. "This couple wants to adopt her child, but she won't let her baby go without a fight." "It'll blow over," Mrs. Richardson said to Mrs. McCullough now. "People will forget about it. It'll pass." But it did not pass. Improbable as it seemed, something about the story had touched a nerve in the community. The news was slow. A woman had septuplets. Bears, the New York Times reported with a straight face, were the main cause of car break-ins at Yosemite. The most pressing political question, for a few more weeks at least, was what President Clinton would name his new dog. The city of Cleveland was safe and bored, and eager for a sensation a bit closer to home. On Friday morning, there were two more camera crews at the McCulloughs' door, and three segments that evening, on channels 5, 19, and 43. Footage of Bibi Chow holding a picture of Mei Ling at 1 month old, pleading for her baby back. Shots of the McCulloughs' house with its curtains drawn and front door light off. A photo of Mr. and Mrs. McCullough dressed in black tie at a benefit for leukemia that had run in the glossy society pages of Shaker magazine the year before. Footage of Mr. McCullough's BMW backing out of the garage and driving away as a reporter jogged alongside, holding a microphone up to the window. By Saturday, all the camera crews were back. Mrs. McCullough had locked herself in the house with Mirabelle, and the secretaries in Mr. McCullough's investment firm had been instructed to decline any calls from news sources with no comment. Every night, Mirabelle McCullough, or Mei Ling Chow, as some pointedly chose to call her, was a featured story on the evening news, always accompanied by photographs. At first, there was only Bibi's snapshot of Mei Ling as a newborn, but then, on the advice of the McCullough's lawyer, who wanted to provide a counterpoint, came more recent portraits from the McCulloughs, taken at the Dillard's photo studio, showing Mirabelle in a frilly yellow Easter dress with bunny ears, or in a pink romper standing beside an old-fashioned rocking horse. Supporters were emerging on both sides, and by Saturday afternoon, a local lawyer, Ed Lim, had offered to represent Bibi Chow, gratis, and sue the state for custody of her daughter. Saturday evening at dinner, Mr. Richardson announced, "Mark and Linda McCullough called this afternoon to ask if I'd work with a lawyer. Seems he doesn't have a lot of court experience, and they thought I might be a good backup." Lexi nibbled at her salad. "So will you?" "None of this is their fault, you know," Mr. Richardson sawed off a bite of chicken. "They just want to do right by the baby. And the suit isn't directed at them. It's at the state. But they'll be dragged into it, and they'll be the ones who'll be affected by it most." "Except for Mirabelle," Izzy said. Mrs. Richardson opened her mouth for a sharp remark, but Mr. Richardson quieted her with a glance. "This whole thing is about Mirabelle, Izzy," he said. "Everyone involved. We all just want what's best for her. We just have to figure out what that is." "We," Izzy thought. Her father had become part of this already. She thought of the image the newspaper kept running of Bibi Chow, the sadness in her eyes, the palm-sized photo of baby Mei Ling in her hand, one corner creased as if it had been kept in a pocket, which it had. Right away, she'd recognized the woman she'd seen in Mia's kitchen, who had fallen silent as soon as she'd come in, who'd stared at her as if she were afraid, almost hunted. "Just a friend," Mia had said, when Izzy had asked who she was. And if Mia trusted Bibi, Izzy knew where her loyalties lay. "Baby stealer," she said. A shocked silence dropped over the table like a heavy cloth. Across the table, Lexi and Tripp exchanged wary, unsurprised glances. Moody shot Izzy a look that said, "Shut up," but she wasn't watching.
"Izzy, apologize to your father," said Mrs. Richardson. "What for?" Izzy demanded. "They're practically kidnapping her, and everyone's just letting them. Daddy's even helping."
"Let's calm down," Mr. Richardson began, but it was too late. When it came to Izzy, Mrs. Richardson was seldom calm, and for that matter, Izzy herself never was.
"Izzy, go to your room."
Izzy turned to her father.
"Maybe they could just pay her off. How much is a baby worth in today's market? $10,000?
"Isabel Marie Richardson."
"Maybe they can bargain her down to $5,000.
Izzy dropped her fork onto her plate with a clatter and left the room. Mia should hear about this, she thought, running upstairs and into her bedroom. She would know what to do. She would know how to fix this. Lexi's laugh floated up the stairwell and down the hallway, and Izzy slammed the door shut. Downstairs, Mrs. Richardson sank back into her seat, hands shaking. It would take her until the next morning to think of a suitable punishment for Izzy. Confiscating her beloved Doc Martens and throwing them in the trash. "If you dress like a thug," she would insist as she opened the trash barrel, "of course you act like a thug." For now, she pressed her lips together tightly and set her knife and fork down in a neat X across her plate. "Should we keep the news quiet?" she asked. "That you're working with the McCulloughs, I mean." Mr. Richardson shook his head.
"It'll be in the paper tomorrow," he said, and he was right.
On Sunday, the Plain Dealer ran the story on the front page, just below the fold. "Local mother fights for daughter's custody." It was a good article, Mrs. Richardson thought, sipping her coffee and skimming over it with a professional eye. An overview of the case, a quick mention that the McCulloughs would be represented by William Richardson of Kleiman, Richardson, and Fish, a statement from B.B. Chow's lawyer.
"We are confident," said Edward Lim, "that the state will see fit to return custody of Mei Ling Chow to her biological mother."
The very fact that the paper had run it so prominently, however, suggested that the real coverage was only beginning. At the bottom of the article, a single sentence caught Mrs. Richardson's eye. Miss Chow had been informed of her daughter's whereabouts by a co-worker at Lucky Palace, a Chinese restaurant on Warrensville Road. Even so carefully and anonymously phrased, she realized with a jolt who that co-worker must be. It could not be a coincidence. So it was her tenant, her quiet, little, eager-to-please tenant, who had started all of this, who had, for reasons still unclear, decided to upend the poor McCulloughs' lives. Mrs. Richardson folded the paper precisely and set it down on the table. She thought again of Mia's disaffection when she'd offered to buy one of Mia's photos, of Mia's reticence about her past, of Mia's, well, standoffishness, even as she spent hours a day in Mrs. Richardson's own home, in this very kitchen. A woman whose wages she paid, whose rent she had subsidized, whose daughter spent hours and hours under this very roof every single day. She thought of the photograph at the art museum, which now, in her memory, took on a secretive, sly tinge. How hypocritical of Mia, with her stubborn privacy, to insert herself into places where she didn't belong. But that was Mia, wasn't it? A woman who took an almost perverse pleasure in flaunting the normal order. It was unfairness itself that this woman was causing such trouble for her dear friend Linda, that Linda should have to suffer for it. On Monday, she sent the children to school and dawdled at home until Mia arrived to clean. She wasn't sure what she was looking for, but she needed to see Mia in person, to look her in the eyes. "Oh," Mia said as she came in the side door. "I didn't expect you to be home. Should I come back later?" Mrs. Richardson tipped her head to one side and studied her tenant. Hair, as always, unkempt atop her head. A loose white button-down untucked over jeans. A smudge of paint on the back of one wrist. Mia stood there with one hand on the doorway, a half-smile on her face, waiting for Mrs. Richardson to respond. A sweet face. A young face, but not an innocent face. She didn't care, Mrs. Richardson realized, what people thought of her. In a way, that made her dangerous. She thought suddenly of the photograph she'd seen at Mia's house that first day when she'd invited Mia into her home. The woman turned arachnid, all silent, stealthy arms. What kind of person, she thought, would transform a woman into a spider? What kind of person, for that matter, saw a woman and even thought spider? I'm just leaving, she said, and lifted her bag from the counter. Even years later, Mrs. Richardson would insist that that digging into Mia's past was nothing more than justified retribution for the trouble Mia had stirred up. It was purely for Linda's sake, she would insist, her oldest and dearest friend, a woman who'd only been trying to do right by this baby and now, because of Mia, was having her heart broken. Linda did not deserve that. How could she, Elena, stand by and let someone ruin her best friend's happiness? She would never admit, even to herself, that it hadn't been about the baby at all. It had been some complicated thing about Mia herself. The dark discomfort this woman stirred up that Mrs. Richardson would have much preferred to have kept in its box. For now, the newspaper still in her hand, she told herself that it was for Linda. She would make a few calls. She would see what she could find out. 11. Mrs. Richardson's first step was to read up on Pauline Hawthorne. She'd heard of Pauline Hawthorne before, of course. When she'd taken her art electives in college, Pauline Hawthorne had been the hot new thing, much talked about, much imitated by the photography students who wandered the campus with cameras strung around their necks like badges. Now that she saw the photographs again, she remembered them. A woman seen in the mirror of a beauty parlor, half her hair wound neatly in curlers, the other half streaming loose in a tousled swirl. A woman touching up her makeup in the side mirror of a Chrysler, cigarette dangling from her lacquered lips. A woman in an emerald green housecoat and heels, vacuuming her goldenrod carpet, the colors so saturated they seemed to bleed. Striking enough that even all these years later, she remembered seeing them flashed up on the projector screen in the darkened lecture hall, catching her breath as for a moment she was plunged into that vibrant technicolor world. Pauline, she learned now, had been born in rural Maine and moved to Manhattan at the age of 18, living for several years in Greenwich Village before bursting onto the art scene in the early 1970s. Every art book Mrs. Richardson consulted described her in glowing terms, a self-taught genius, a feminist photographic pioneer, a dynamic and generous intellect. About her personal life, Mrs. Richardson could find very little. Only a brief mention that she had maintained an apartment on the Upper East Side. She did find one interesting tidbit, however. Pauline Hawthorne had taught at the New York School of Fine Arts, though apparently not out of need for money. A few years into Pauline Hawthorne's career, her photographs had been selling for tens of thousands, quite a lot for a photographer of that time, let alone a woman. After her death in 1982, their value skyrocketed, with MoMA paying nearly $2 million to add one to its permanent collection. On a hunch, Mrs. Richardson looked up the number for the registrar at the New York School of Fine Arts. The registrar, when presented with Mrs. Richardson's credentials and told she was verifying some facts for a story, proved to be extremely helpful. Pauline Hawthorne had taught the advanced photography class at the school for many years, right up until the year she had died. No, there was no Mia Warren in any of Professor Hawthorne's classes in those last few years, but there had been a Mia Wright in the fall of 1980. Might that be who Mrs. Richardson was looking for? Mia Wright, it turned out, had enrolled that term in the School of Fine Arts as a freshman, but in the spring of 1981 had requested and been granted a leave of absence for the following academic year. She had never returned. Mrs. Richardson, doing some quick mental math, calculated that Mia, if this was even the same Mia, would not yet have been pregnant with Pearl that spring. So why would Mia have taken a leave from school, if not because she was pregnant? The registrar balked at giving out student addresses, even 15-year-old ones, but Mrs. Richardson managed to learn, through some artful questioning, that the address on file for Mia Wright had been a local one, with no parents listed. She would have to work the problem from the other end, then. And soon, an opportunity presented itself, in the form of a much-anticipated letter. Since Thanksgiving, Lexi had checked the mail first thing when she came home. And at last, in mid-December, a fat envelope bearing the Yale logo in the corner finally landed in their mailbox. Mrs. Richardson had called all their relatives to share the good news. Mr. Richardson arrived home with a cake. "Lexi, I'm taking you out for a fancy brunch this weekend to celebrate," Mrs. Richardson said at dinner. "After all, it's not every day you get into Yale. We'll have some fun girl time." "What about me?" Moody said. "I just get to stay home and eat cereal." "She said fun girl time," Tripp laughed, and Moody scowled. "You want in on fun girl time?" "Now, Moody," Mrs. Richardson said, "it's like Tripp said. This is just to celebrate Lexi. We're going to get dressed up and have a little girl's morning out." "Then what about me?" Izzy demanded. "Does that mean I get to come?" Mrs. Richardson had not anticipated this, but Lexi's eyes were already alight. Lexi was already chattering about where she wanted to go, and it was too late to say no. And then, that evening, as she was washing her face before bed, an idea occurred to Mrs. Richardson, a way this luncheon might serve another purpose, too. The next afternoon, she came into the sunroom just before dinner. Under normal circumstances, she left the kids alone, feeling that teens needed their space, that they were entitled to some degree of privacy. Today, though, she was looking for Pearl. As always, she was sprawled on the couch with Lexi and Tripp and Moody, all of them half sunk into its overstuffed cushions. Izzy lay on her stomach on the armchair, chin propped on one armrest, feet in the air over the other.
"Pearl, there you are,"
Mrs. Richardson began. She settled herself gingerly on the arm of the sofa beside Pearl. "The girls and I are going out for brunch on Saturday to celebrate Lexi's good news. Why don't you come, too?"
"Me?"
Pearl threw a quick glance over her shoulder, as if Mrs. Richardson might be talking to someone else.
"You're practically part of the family, aren't you?" Mrs. Richardson laughed.
"Of course you should come," Lexi said. "I want you to."
"Go tell your mother," Mrs. Richardson said. "She's in the kitchen. I'm sure she'll say it's all right. Tell her it's my treat. Tell her," she added, "that I insist."
Across the room, Izzy slowly pushed herself up on her elbows, eyes narrowing. It had been over 3 weeks since her mother had promised to look into Mia's mysterious photograph, and when she'd asked about it, her mother had said only,
"Oh, Izzy, you always make such a big deal out of nothing."
Now her sudden interest in Pearl struck Izzy as strange.
"Why'd you invite her?"
she demanded, once Pearl had skipped out of hearing.
"Izzy, how often does Pearl get to go out to brunch? You need to learn to be more generous."
Mrs. Richardson rose and straightened her blouse.
"Besides, I thought you liked Pearl."
This was how Pearl found herself at a wooden table in the corner next to Lexi, across from Mrs. Richardson and a sulky Izzy. Lexi had chosen the 100th Bomb Group, a restaurant out near the airport where the family went for very special occasions, the most recent being Mr. Richardson's 44th birthday. The 100th Bomb Group was crowded that morning, a dizzying swirl of activity in a bewildering buffet that stretched the length of the room. At a carving station, a burly man in a white apron sliced roast beef from an enormous, rare haunch. At the omelet station, chefs poured a stream of frothy golden egg into a skillet and turned out a fluffy omelet filled with whatever you desired, even things it had never occurred to Pearl to put in an omelet. Mushrooms, asparagus, coral-colored chunks of lobster. All over the walls hung memorabilia of the men from the bomb squadron. Maps of major battles against the Nazis, their medals, their dog tags, their letters to sweethearts at home. Photographs of their planes, photographs of the men themselves, dashing in uniforms and cadet hats and the occasional mustache. "Look at him," Lexi said, tapping a photo just behind Pearl's ear. "Captain John C. Sinclair. Wouldn't you just love to meet him?" "You realize," Izzy said, "that if he's still alive, he'd be about 94 now. Probably has a walker." "I mean, wouldn't you have wanted to meet him if you'd been alive back then? Way to split hairs, Izzy." "He probably bombed cities, you know," Izzy said. "He probably killed lots of innocent people. All these guys probably did." She waved a hand at the expanse of photographs around them. "Izzy," Mrs. Richardson said, "let's save the history lesson for another time. We're here to celebrate Lexi's achievement." She beamed across the table at Lexi, and by extension at Pearl, who sat beside her. "To Lexi," she said, raising her Bloody Mary, and Lexi and Pearl raised their goblets of orange juice, luminous in the sun. "To Lexi," Izzy echoed. "I'm sure Yale will be all you've ever wanted." She took a swig from her water glass, as if wishing it were something stronger. At the table beside them, a baby slammed its chubby palms on the tablecloth, and the silverware jumped with a clatter. "Oh, my God," Lexi mouthed. She leaned across the aisle toward the baby.
"You are so cute." "Yes, you are. You're the cutest baby in the entire world."
Izzy rolled her eyes and stood up. "Keep an eye on her," she said to the baby's parents. "You never know when someone might steal your baby." Before anyone could respond, she headed across the room toward the buffet. "Please excuse my daughter," Mrs. Richardson said to the parents. "She's at a difficult age." She smiled at the baby, who was now trying to cram the fat end of a spoon into its mouth. "Lexi, Pearl, why don't you go ahead, too? I'll wait here." When everyone was back at the table, Mrs. Richardson began the delicate work of turning the conversation by degrees. As it happened, it was easier than she'd expected. She began with that trusty topic, the weather. She hoped it wouldn't be too cold for Lexi in New Haven. They would have to order her a warmer coat from L.L. Bean, a new pair of duck boots, a down duvet. Then she turned to Pearl. "How about you, Pearl?" she said. "Have you ever been to New Haven?" Pearl swallowed a forkful of omelet and shook her head. "No, I never have. My mom doesn't like the East Coast much."
"Really?"
Mrs. Richardson said. She slid the tip of her knife into a poached egg and the yolk ran out in a golden puddle. "That's a shame you've never been able to travel out there. So much to see. So much culture. We took a trip to Boston a few years ago. Remember, girls? The Freedom Trail and the Tea Party ship and Paul Revere's house. And, of course, there's New York. So much to do there." She gave Pearl a benevolent smile. "I hope you'll be able to see it someday. I truly believe there's nothing like travel to broaden a young person's perspective." Pearl felt stung, as Mrs. Richardson had known she would. "Oh, we've traveled a lot," she said. "We've been all over the place. Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska." She paused, casting about for something more glamorous. "We've even been out to California a few times."
"How wonderful,"
Mrs. Richardson refilled Pearl's glass from the carafe of juice on the table. "You really have been all over."
"Quite the traveler, actually."
"And do you like it, moving around so much?"
"It's okay."
Pearl stabbed a piece of egg with her fork. "I mean, we move whenever my mom finishes a project. New places give her new ideas."
"You're growing up to be a real citizen of the world," Mrs. Richardson said,
and Pearl, despite herself, blushed.
"You probably know more about this country than any other teenager, even Lexi and Izzy, and we travel quite a bit. Even Lexi and Izzy have only been to a handful of states."
Then, casually, "Where have you spent the most time? Where you were born, I imagine."
"Well," Pearl swallowed the egg, "I was born in San Francisco, but we left when I was just a baby. I don't remember it at all. We never stay in any place too long."
Mrs. Richardson filed this piece of information away in her brain.
You'll have to go back someday, she said. I believe in knowing where your roots lie.
That kind of thing shapes your identity so much. I was born right here in Shaker. Did you know that?